The Guardian.
It's a milestone. It's just the start. It really is just the start. It's the first time we've had collisions at this very high centre of mass energy. But really, there's a huge amount still to do. We're really on the start of the road of discovery.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast, what are they thinking? We take a peek inside the minds of animals and ask, do dogs get offended and do fish feel pain?
With monkeys, if they're both handed slices of cucumber, they happily receive them. But if you start giving one of them desirable grapes, which are a real treat for them, and the other one continues to get a cucumber, he or she will throw it aside or hand it back or expect the equitable treatment.
The Large Hadron Collider makes history again.
If we don't find anything like dark matter or even things like the Higgs boson or all these wonderful theories that theorists have been dreaming about for years, if we don't find any of that, that just means, right, well, something might be wrong with gravity. And that's a big if.
So what's next for CERN? We speak to one of those who'll be scouring the data. Plus, how effective is YouTube for debunking science myths?
Some people don't like the fact that I attack Al Gore. I wouldn't say I attack him. I just dispute the things that he says because they're not in line with the scientific consensus.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now we're beginning this podcast by exploring the mind and emotions of animals. Jonathan Balcom used to be an animal behaviour researcher with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. His latest book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals, is out now. It explores all things to do with animals, their sensitivity, their emotions, intelligence, whether they're aware, how they communicate, whether they have virtue. The Guardian's James Randerson spoke to him.
There's been a scientific revolution going on in the last two or three decades. Through much of the 20th century, it was taboo to ask questions about what animals think and what they feel. And fortunately, that's changed. It's an exciting time to study animal behavior. And now we have a spate of studies on these phenomena that show that animals are, in all the important ways, sentient in the manner that we are. They may not lead the same sorts of lives that we have, but the key element here, in my view, is that they feel pleasures and pains just as intensely as we do. They have just as acute emotional experience as we do. There are studies showing that animals are aware, that they're cognitive, that there's a real inner life to these animals that we haven't really been appreciating in the past. So that's the sort of the showcase part of my book, where I showcase these scientific discoveries peppered with anecdotes and stories. And then the ethical take-home message is, well, as you said, what does it say about our relationship to animals? The paradox is that as our knowledge of animals increases, our treatment of them falls further behind, because we still live according to a sort of a might makes right strategy, which is the kind of thinking that justified colonialism and slavery and the subjugation of women's rights and civil rights in the past. And we've made great strides in relegating those wrongs to the history books. But today, unfortunately, our treatment of animals remains pretty much medieval. And so my book is also a plea to the reader and to the humanity in general to strive for a new relationship to animals, a relationship that's less consumptive and more respectful.
The sort of showcase part of the book is packed with examples. Well, one of the first ones you talk about are the chickens and their aesthetic preferences. I mean, just to get a flavour of some of these examples, perhaps you could talk us through that particular experiment.
Sure. It's a study published in a journal, and the title of the paper, which was originally going to be the title of my book, is Chickens Prefer Beautiful Humans. And it was a study done in which human faces were photographed and digitized so they could be presented a sort of a range of faces. And they were presented to undergraduate students, and the undergraduate students rated them for attractiveness. Male faces were rated by female students, and female faces were rated by male students. And so they came up with sort of a gradation of what was most and least attractive. And then chickens were presented with the same range of faces. And strikingly, chickens, for whatever reason, and that could be discussed as to what was going on in the chickens' minds, but their ratings, their preferences in binary choices, one face versus another, were about 98% overlap with the human raters. So an astonishing overlap and similarity in aesthetic race rating. Now, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that chickens found those faces more attractive. I don't know. I think that was what the authors suggest. But whether that, what kind of meaning that has in terms of a chicken's world, I don't know. But what it does say to me is that A, they're very, very perceptive about cues, and B, those perceptions are very similar to ours in terms of aesthetics.
It's very easy to extrapolate from anecdotes or small studies because, you know, to use a slightly analogous situation, people tend to see sort of faces in clouds or hear voices in drafts in drafty buildings. You know, we are very good at anthropomorphizing our surroundings. And clearly there's been, as you say, a revolution in our understanding of the cognitive abilities of animals and all sorts of things that people, you know, a century ago didn't even consider animals were capable of. They are. But whether that's really the same thing as human emotions in the same way we would understand them, I think is a very open question, isn't it?
Sure. Let me give an example of an emotional study that's based on rigorous science. It's a study of Chacma baboons. And these animals, these particular populations, have been studied in Botswana for 30 years by the same scientists. So it's sort of like the Jane Goodall type science, where you have longitudinal data, long-term observational and experimental type studies with animals in the wild, in their own milieu. It's known that women who lose an infant, it's a terrible, traumatic, sad event, and they grieve naturally, and that grief is reflected physiologically by an increase in glucocorticoid hormones in their blood for a month or more. And these baboons show a similar pattern of behavior. If a baboon mother out there in the Okavango Delta of Botswana loses her baby, the scientists are able to measure the hormone levels in her blood in a very non-invasive way. They don't have to draw blood. They simply keep an eye and they see when the female defecates somewhere, you know, oh, Lucy just shat, go get that. And they run over and pick it up and they can do analyses on the feces that show that their hormone levels also increase and their glucocorticoid levels go up for about a month. Very, very similar pattern. Their closest associates are the female baboons with whom they relate to and have friendships with. They're sort of an osmotic effect. Their hormone levels also go up. And again, in parallel with humans, in the human case, we rally around, we support each other, we increase our social networks. And the baboons show a similar pattern. They females who've lost an infant will groom more during that next month and receive more grooming. And it's thought to be sort of a form of therapy to help overcome the grief that presumably they're experiencing. So, you know, this is the challenge with emotions. They're private feelings. And this is one of the reasons why science did neglect these questions for a long time. It was ruled as scientifically inaccessible. So, you know, don't even ask those questions because we can't go there. Well, actually, science is incredibly innovative, and we can come up with ways to probe the depths of what animals may be thinking and feeling. And ultimately, it's private experiences. But then, James, your experiences are private to me. I can only be empathic or guess what, you know, if I say I share your pain or I feel your pain, I'm being empathic. I'm not literally feeling your pain. So that challenge also extends between humans. And yet we do not question the sentience of our fellow human beings.
Do animals have any kind of moral responsibility?
Absolutely. In fact, it's sort of one of the frontiers of science is this study of virtue in animals, and increasingly it's coming to light that to somewhat twist your question, because you said moral responsibility, and that's maybe a bit different than what I'm about to describe. But certainly a moral awareness or a moral consideration about how they behave. And this is particularly the case with social animals, animals who've evolved to live in groups. And living in groups is full of compromise. You know, you give and take, and you want to sustain good relationships with others. If you don't, you may be an outcast, and that's usually not in your self-interest anyway. So one can make genetic arguments for the evolution of virtue and moral behavior, and certainly we manifest it in many ways. But for instance, a recent study of dogs shows that dogs have what's called inequity aversion. That is to say, they have sort of a fairness awareness. If you offer a hand to shake a paw with two dogs and they're standing next to each other, and each time you shake their paw, one dog gets a treat for shaking the paw and the other one doesn't get a treat. Well, after about 10 or 12 trials, the one who's not getting a treat will refuse to shake the paws, whereas the other one will continue happily to shake paws. And control experiments where there's no other dog dog there, the dog not getting any treat will continue shaking the paw much longer. So it's not just fatigue or frustration. They're actually, there's this sort of awareness that, hey, this is not correct. This one's getting rewarded for what I'm what he's doing, and I'm not getting rewarded for what I'm doing. The same thing. Similarly with monkeys, if they're both handed slices of cucumber, they happily receive them. But if you start giving one of them desirable grapes, which are a real treat for them, and the other one continues to get a cucumber, he or she will throw it aside or hand it back or expect the equitable treatment.
But aren't those kind of behaviors just part of an inner sort of selfishness? They're not, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that those animals are sort of altruistic or have morals.
Yeah, you could argue it's ultimately selfish. You could argue a lot of our behavior is ultimately selfish in the sense that it ultimately will serve us either through kin selection or reciprocal altruism, to again use some scientific jargon. But there's also a lot of examples of altruistic behavior in nature where animals individuals incur an individual sacrifice to make a certain behavior, which is beneficial to the group. A great example is alarm calling, and this is quite widespread in birds and mammals. I talk about some birds using this, but also mammals like prairie dogs, you know, these middle-sized rodents. They have a sophisticated alarm calling system. So do chickens. And it's a semantic system where specific calls denote specific types of predators, and specific calls and predators denote result in a specific behavior that's adaptive to that. For instance, if an eagle's flying over their prairie dog colony, there's a particular call given, and any prairie dog who hears the call and knows it will run immediately to the hole and go down the burrow because you want to be out of the way. They're the most dangerous predator, with the possible exception of a human with a gun, which incidentally they have a distinctive call for a human carrying a gun. They also have a call for coyotes, which engenders a different response. Run to the burrow, stay at the entrance, and just look around alertly. If it's a domestic dog, well, they're a little more predictable and less dangerous, so just stand alert and watch where you are. And these, of course, these studies are done by doing playback experiments where they record the calls and play them back. But they even have up to 100 modifiers for these calls, which denote different colors, different shapes, different sizes. Again, if somebody is walking through with or without a gun, for obvious reasons, it's useful to know the difference between those two scenarios.
Yes. Do plants have an intrinsic value?
You know, my broad philosophy is a little bit like Albert Schweitzer, who advocated an idea of reverence for life. You know, he coined that phrase in 1915, and I love that phrase. And it speaks to plants because plants are, of course, also living organisms. There's not really any science to support, or very little. Some would argue they're sentient. We can quibble about whether plants are sentient. Most scientists would say they're not. But even if they are sentient, we ought to respect them. And that relates to the broader issue of our relationship to animals, because people often ask me, as a vegetarian, myself, and a vegan, in fact, they ask me, what about plants? You know, if you're a vegetarian, you're consuming plants, but if you're a meat eater, you're indirectly consuming many more plants, because of course you're eating higher on the food chain, and cows have to eat plants to make muscle. And being a vegetarian is a more plant friendly way of life anyway. So I believe in respecting all life. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to see trees uprooted any more than I want to see cows slaughtered. But there is a moral difference, because a cow is sentient and the plant is not.
I want to come on to this issue of where this sort of new knowledge takes us, in your view, in terms of our relationship, our moral relationship with animals in particular. I mean, in the book, there's a quite colourful way into this, actually, where you talk about that scene from the Monty Python's Holy Grail. Perhaps you could just talk us through that and why you think it's relevant.
Yeah, that's the introduction to the last part of the book, and I do indulge myself. I read that passage to a high school class a couple of days ago. It was a writer's workshop, and one of the braver students took me to task a little bit for overquoting from that section. But if anyone's seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, there's a scene with a couple of serfs who are out in the countryside slinging earth, slinging mud around, just doing some menial task, filthy. And King Arthur rides along. Well, he's not riding. He's got someone with coconuts, sounding like a horse. And it comes up and it wants to find out which knight lives in yonder castle. And the two serfs start to get into a dialogue with him. And it turns out they're experts on social politics and social dynamics and justice and things like that. And the king gets very irritated at them and just telling them to shut up. And I see this as a sort of a metaphor for the human-animal relationship. We're the kings and they're the serfs. And for a long time now, we've been sitting in our throne, having them do what we want them to do and treating them as our will dictates. And it's not long ago that we were treating other humans that way. Colonialism and slavery, I think I may have mentioned those earlier, but certainly those sorts of past wrongs were justified because we were more important, we're more intelligent, we matter, we're the only ones that really matter. So I don't think Monty Python intended that to be a metaphor for our relationship to animals and humans, but certainly good literature and good humor can be a metaphor for these other things.
Is there any form of a kind of hierarchy of sentience that you recognize? I mean, would it be okay to do certain things with, say, fish as opposed to, monkeys or apes?
It's an important question. I mean, sentience is not an absolute in the sense, well, let's say there's gradients of sentience. I'm sure there are gradients of sentience. There's certain levels of being able to perceive and feel things, just as our sensory systems vary. You know, some species have more acute visual ability than we do, and a more better sense of smell, and better, say, spatial memory as well. So, so we can argue about where we draw the line, and that's sort of a draw the line type of issue is, who do we include, who do we exclude? Amoebas, they're technically qualified as animals, but I don't believe they're sentient. Cockroaches, we might start to debate that a little bit. What I think is key, though, is there's a number of animals we can put definitely and clearly above the line of the sort of sentience that really matters. The capacity to feel things similarly to the way we are. And we know how sentient we are. We know how much it hurts to hammer our thumb or stick a needle into our body, even though a lot of people seem to like doing that. So we know we're sentient. So it's really an exercise in empathy, is recognizing that warthog or that chicken or whatever animal you want to pick. I mean, if it's a mammal and bird, absolutely, I think we're talking about similar levels of sentience. We could argue about reptiles and amphibians and fishes. I do want to mention something about fishes. They're so often dismissed as Cartesian automatons and thoughtless, unthinking, cold-blooded brutes that don't really, well, not even brutes. They're not even worthy of the word brute. They're just fish. And I think they have the disadvantage of not having facial expressions, at least not that we recognize.
Slightly gormless ones, to our eyes, I suppose.
To our eyes, they seem slightly gormless. But you know what? So do dolphins. Dolphins don't look gormless to our eyes. We know they've got bigger brains than we have, and yet they have fixed facial expressions too. And that's one of the common anthropomorphisms where we go astray. The dolphin's happy because he's smiling, but of course they can't change that sort of facial expression. They can express emotions in other ways among each other with body postures and such, but we're not so good at reading that. And of course they have a sophisticated vocal communication system. Fishes, just on the surface, no pun intended, fishes don't look particularly sentient. But there's a new book just came out last week called Do Fish Feel Pain by a fish biologist who's an expert in them. And she concludes that they certainly can. And as a fellow evolutionary biologist, James, you probably would appreciate the value of being able to feel pain for a motile organism, an organism that can move away. Now, okay, granted, amoebas are also motile. They can move. But fishes have a lot more, they have nervous tissue and they have the same sorts of senses we have. And there are studies that show they have long-term memory, that they show physiological and behavioral responses to painful stimuli. Having acetic acid injected into their lips, trout will stop feeding for hours unless or until they're given an antidote to that, and then they'll start feeding again. So these sorts of things are pretty compelling evidence that they can feel pain. And my doctrine with this sort of question, the difficult questions about animal sentience, is that if there's doubt, we ought to grant them the benefit of the doubt rather than the other way around, which is what we've tended to be doing.
That was Jonathan Balcom speaking to The Guardian's James Randerson. Jonathan's book, Second Nature, is out now. Do you agree that animals have a passion for life? Could you give up meat? Tell us what you think through our Facebook group. Just search for The Guardian Science Weekly Podcast. You can also chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. And we'll message you every Monday when a new programme is available to download.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
And now, the Large Hadron Collider is finally up to speed. Yep, the most complex scientific instrument in the world is beginning its long search for new particles, forces, and extra dimensions of space. The machine is designed to collide beams of protons with a combined energy of 14 trillion electron volts. We had a false start 18 months ago. Then the LHC started colliding protons at low energies in November. Now we're up to half speed, and look set to keep on that till the end of 2011. So these 7 tera electron volt collisions mean that the LHC is now 3 times more energetic than the US Tevatron Collider near Chicago. To help guide us through the experiment, we've got Tom Winty from Imperial College in the studio. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Now, you're a third-year PhD student. You're working on the compact muon solenoid experiment. It's one of those giant digital cameras that's going to take pictures of the particles colliding inside the LHC. You were watching when we finally got up to half speed last week. How was it?
It was obviously a great moment. I was actually at a conference at the time, a particle physics conference, and I was largely following on Twitter, actually.
So now we're up to interesting speed. Why is this a significant milestone? Why is everybody so excited about this particular getting to this energy?
So a lot was made last week of how it was a historic moment in particle physics, and it really was. I mean, if you look back through the last century's achievements in physics, particle physics really sort of kicked off as a discipline in the 40s and 50s. It was a real sort of, it was a gentleman adventurer type subject where you to find new particles, you had to do sort of crazy things. You had to like send photographic emulsions up on balloons into the atmosphere and then wait for them to land somewhere. And that's how you'd analyze collisions like that. And people would find these cosmic rays, the tracks left by those, and found new particles like that. You had people going on expeditions to the Andes and up mountains taking these photographic plates to get closer to where these cosmic rays are coming down. The problem is with that, you don't know what is your input from that. You don't know where the cosmic rays have come from. So physics is all about control and knowing what goes in. And that's when people started to build colliders like the Hadron Collider. Now, it used to be you could fit one of these things on a desk, on a lab, and you had these little things and it would whiz round. And they just got sort of gradually bigger and bigger. But what they found when they smashed particles together, they found whole new families of these particles. They found loads. And there was a real genuine concern in the physics community that physics would turn into biology, essentially, and that you'd have all these species of particles that no one had seen. You'd have to sort of label them and do the sort of taxonomy and the genus lines, and no one wants to do that, really. No one enjoys that, at least in physics. What you want is you want nice, simple explanations of and patterns in nature. And the experimentalists had the edge. We had the data. Off you go, guys. Off you go, theorists. Explain what's going on, which they did beautifully. But the point is now we're back. Back where we were in the 50s,
back in
and 60s,
the experimentalist stream.
Having the we are, as we speak now, producing data that theorists just don't have a clue about. They've got ideas and they've got models and theories, but what's nice as an experimentalist myself is that we have this stuff that we'll be able to say, look, this is what we're finding.
So what are you finding at the moment? Tell us what you're working on particularly.
The analysis I'm involved in, the particular search, is for dark matter. It is one of the greatest mysteries of modern physics. Cosmology, so people looking in their telescopes and satellite telescopes and all sorts of things, tells us that if gravity works as we think it does, there should be more stuff than we can actually see.
So how are you finding that?
Well, it's very much relies on the good old E equals mc squared. If we've got enough energy, we can create new particles that have mass. Now, for this these mass calculations to add up in terms of the universe, these particles have to have a mass, and it's by definition it's a mass that it's greater than what we've been able to see before. So the hope is that we create enough energy in our proton-proton collisions to create this dark matter stuff. So rather than it just existing in the universe around us or in galaxies as we think it's clustered, we're actually making it.
But how do you detect it?
Ah, well, this is the golden question. By definition, you can't.
Quite.
Of course, it would pass straight through our detectors, and this is why the experiment, the Large Hadron Collider approach, is crucial in this point, because we know what went in. We know we had two protons at 3.5 tera electron volts each. We know that energy is conserved, so we know that nothing should disappear according to the laws of physics. I mean, if that's broken, we're in trouble.
that's a whole other question.
Yeah. Well, this is it, and we've got to be open to it. It's that's part of the fun of science. So if stuff does appear to disappear.
So if there's some energy you can't find,
yes,
then that's presumably the
yes,
dark matter that you're looking
yes,
for.
Yes. We know there are particles that do disappear as well, like neutrinos, these kind of ghostly particles that the standard model, they're incorporated in the standard model, and we have discovered already. But the point is, if more disappears than we think, according to those predictions, then we'll have a hint at saying, right, something else is going on here. And that's when we ask for the next collider and some more money.
Please. A bigger machine. What does what you're working on actually look like? What is it?
It's a good question. And part of the challenge and the fun of the next few months will be really understanding what our detectors are telling us. So essentially you have lots of different types of detection equipment, sort of silicon chips, sort of a bit similar to what you've got on your mobile phone camera sort of thing. You have calorimeters, which measure the energy that all the particles leave, and various other types. And these generate electric signals, which then get processed by big sort of boards of electronics and what have you. And then this gets all filtered out. And essentially, yeah, you get these little... gets to the ones and zeros formats, and then you have reconstruction software, which essentially is pattern recognition, and that's a big challenge of analyzing this data, is it's looking for patterns, looking for the right thing. And again, to look back at this in the context of history, what used to happen is that they would literally take photos of the collisions. You would have photographic plates, and you'd have then people taking these photos and analyzing, you know, measuring them with rulers and looking at the tracks and the tracks.
Well, and looking at the different sparks of light and measuring the path of the particle.
And now we do that all by computer. And that's one of the major challenges. It's not just analyzing the data, looking for the right patterns or what we think are the right patterns, and we don't even know if they're the right patterns, right? This is why it's completely new territory and so exciting. But we've... just the sheer volume of that data. One of the biggest challenges is even working out whether what you've seen is interesting or not.
So do you get a three-dimensional image of a sort of a first pass at where each particle or fraction went, and then you have to sort of work out if that's plausible?
You take as a given that it's plausible in the sense that hopefully that's what your
pattern detector is telling you.
Yes, you get a 3D reconstruction of what happened, what sort of showers of particles appeared or what happened. But then it's the trick is, yeah, developing the clever software that says, this one's good, keep it. This one's not so good, chuck it away. Because we can't save all of these pictures to disk. Another issue.
There's actually just a data storage problem.
I like to think of it as a challenge, as an opportunity rather than a problem. Part of the trick is working out which ones are interesting that you then store and then send out. And there's this huge effort to develop something called the grid, which is this distributed data network of computing. And so you can't physically store it or keep it all at CERN. And there are sites around the world, including at Fermilab, where our rival is. Hopefully they'll look after it properly. Anyway, yeah, but that then goes all over the world and is analysed wherever. And some people are saying, you know, maybe this is the next World Wide Web thing, in that...
you should have a cloud computing kind of solution to your data storage problem.
This is it. This is what we did last time. The point is we don't know. But by trying to solve these challenges, and with hopefully some of the best people who can do it... we can then take those solutions, because CERN is funded by the public. It's funded by, the UK makes a contribution that comes from our tax. And that's why, it's so important that we do fund these things, because we're constantly solving problems, huge technical problems that no one's even attempted before, because we've never had to. But once those solutions are developed, we can give them away for free. People can use them, and then that feeds back and hopefully sort of pays for itself almost.
Oh, well, watch this space. For everything you need to know about the LHC, go to guardian.co.uk/science/CERN.
Science Weekly.
For 100,000 years, humans have looked up at the night sky and wondered about those awesome points of light. What are they? What are they made of? How did they get there? They didn't have the technology to find out, so they guessed that magical beings had created it all. If you prefer making wild guesses instead of using observation, measurement, and calculation, then here's a sealed box. Spend the next 10 minutes guessing what's inside, and come back again at the end of this video. Because this video doesn't cover what we guess about the universe, but what we know, and more importantly, how we know it.
The key to converting climate change skeptics may not be polar bears and doomsday scenarios of submerged cities, but rather an open and honest YouTube channel. Potholer 54 has managed to pull in 28,000 subscribers, and his films have been watched 2.5 million times. He's also known as Peter Hadfield, a former New Scientist writer and ex-BBC journalist. 2 years ago, he began making videos rebutting urban myths about science that were spinning around the internet. The most viewed video on his site is one about those hacked climate change emails.
The earth is cooling, carbon dioxide's good for you, and these people knew it the whole time!
Wow! Oh, the humanity! I'm not going to have time in this video to look at the bitchiness, the derogatory remarks, and the attempts to keep what the emailers regard as bad science out of the scientific literature. If you're interested in that, I'll be happy to make another video.
Some university lecturers are now using his channel as part of their environmental science classes. Peter came into the Guardian studios while over from Australia, and Adam Vaughan asked the questions.
It started with conversations I had with neighbours who were very fundamentalist Christians, and I'm always fascinated to know why people are into certain religions, and I had these conversations with them, and I came to understand that they knew absolutely nothing factually about things like evolution and the Big Bang or anything like that. I mean, it was not that they had different philosophies and different interpretations. It was just that they did not know the basic facts. They thought evolution was, for example, about one species of animal being born from another and ludicrous things like that. And I thought, well, what I can do is because I'm a journalist, is put this into a 10-minute video to explain this to them. And this turned into actually a series. And I put this online basically for them. And it became hugely popular. The reaction was for people, a lot of whom were actually atheists who lived among Christians, and they said, thank goodness, there is something out there that I can show to my Christian friends. But also from a lot of Christians who began to understand for the first time something about science that they had never, ever been taught. Even from people who thanked me profusely for the fact that now they realized they weren't going to hell. They'd had sleepless nights over the fact they thought they were destined for hell. And all of a sudden they had an explanation of the world which was different to the one that they had preconceived, and the gratitude I got was quite amazing, and of course then numbers grew, and it was from that a lot of people said, well, you ought to do one on climate.
You've done a basic sort of primer on here are the facts about climate change. Can you tell me a little bit about the style of your videos, because they're quite distinct?
Yes, I think the trouble with this is there is an awful lot of name-calling, and there's a lot of taking sides, and one thing, when I had conversations with skeptics, if I could use that word, people who didn't accept the scientific consensus on climate change. One thing that came across was they're not stupid people. They're intelligent people who are trying to understand. And they said to me, just tell us the basic facts. We don't want a lot of emotion. We don't want to see more polar bears on ice caps and how we're all going to drown underwater. We want some basic facts about what this is and what's going to happen. So I thought, no, that's what's needed. That was what I had from the series on our creation.
You don't like the term deniers, do you?
I don't like the term denialist. That suggests that there is an observable fact that could be denied. And even the IPCC would say that the certainty over climate science is around 80-90%. Of course, you know, that's as good as a lot of scientific theories get. You could say it's more for evolution, perhaps a bit more for plate tectonics. But you can never ever say that a scientific theory is an absolute fact and that it's undeniable, because once you start doing that, science becomes a dogma and an orthodoxy. And so I'm against that.
And you do get a lot of emails and messages from people. I mean, you're not preaching to the converted, are you, Peter? I mean, I'd be interested. What are they saying?
Yes, I'm getting emails from all sorts of different people. Some of whom actually I've been attacked from both sides, which is probably a good thing. Some people don't like the fact that I attack Al Gore. I wouldn't say I attack him. I just dispute the things that he says because they're not in line with the scientific consensus. Some of his exaggerations, I've called him on it, and I see no reason not to do that. I mean, the whole idea of having my video series is that it's about science, and whatever side you happen to feel you're on, and I don't like the idea that this is a question of taking sides, You know, if you're getting your facts wrong, you need to be called up on it. But I have had people who've criticized me for that, and I've also had people who've criticized me for taking the view that climate change is happening. But that's not my view. That is the view of the scientific consensus. What I'm doing in the series is explaining what scientists have discovered through research. Nothing more than that. This is not my opinion. This is just what's been shown through research. So the emails that I'm getting cover a lot of all manner of the spectrum. And yes, I have had people change their minds over this, which is a very good thing.
That was Peter Hadfield speaking to Adam Vorm from our environment site. If you want to take a look, search for Potholer 54 on YouTube or read Peter's blog post on environmentguardian.co.uk. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, @ScienceWeekly, we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all the Guardian science content, follow @GuardianScience. My thanks to our three studio guests, Jonathan Balcombe, whose book Second Nature is out now, Peter Hadley, and Tom Winty. Next week, Alok should be back, and he'll be sniffing around as Will Andrews tells us about the science of scent and how perfumes are designed. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. While you're there, make sure you subscribe for free, so every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 device. It takes all the hard work out of listening. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.